Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Cale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujeet Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 32, and it's being recorded on the 11th of June, 2014. I'm your host, Sujeet Mello. I'm a consultant with Microsoft in the app dev space, based out of New Jersey. And on Skype with me, I have my two esteemed colleagues and all-time Azure gurus, Cale and Evan. Guys?
Hey, this is Cale. I'm in MCS in the New York region in the app dev space. Deal mostly with .NET development and Azure-related development.
And this is Evan, and I'm a support escalation engineer supporting Windows Azure IaaS.
Great. Thanks for joining, guys. And, you know, last episode we put a call out to our listeners to come back with any real-world scenarios that they may have. You know, some things that they're thinking about putting on Azure, you know, their own infrastructure, current problems that they're facing that they want to maybe put on Azure. And we were actually very fortunate. We did get one of our listeners come back to us with a really nice scenario. So we want to spend a little time today digging into that. So that's going to be the main topic for today is a make it real scenario, as we like to call it. But as always, before we get to that, let's just cover the latest and greatest news on Azure, and there's been quite a lot of it this week, guys, huh?
It's I don't even know if it's every it's this week. It's every week. There's always more.
It's always
like up every day.
I know. Well, let's see if we can get through some of these things. And just so the listeners know, this is all hot off the presses, so you'll have to forgive us if we don't have all the background and detail and all these items, but we wanted to get it out to you. This is all the news that's fit to print for Azure, and we wanted to let you guys have it. So starting off, this is actually a new one. Team Foundation Server, as for some of the non-developers out there, TFS is our, you know, development source control and work item tracking system that Microsoft built. It came out of the old Visual SourceSafe days and grew into a complete system that ties with Visual Studio. They call it the Visual Studio Team System is another way to look at it. But that has a server component, and that server component typically runs on-premises today. So a lot of companies want to put that up on in an IaaS instance in Microsoft Azure. And there's been some guidance that's been put out by some of our colleagues, actually, in the Microsoft Consulting Services who have done similar gigs like this with other customers. They put together some best practices on how best to put TFS on an Azure infrastructure service, IaaS service. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I thought that there was a pretty comprehensive guide that they created.
Yeah, I think we do have to call out the humor that we had out of the title.
Go ahead, Evan.
So the title of this is TFS Planning and DR Avoidance. And as a support guy, I immediately thought back to many a customer I've had that just they figured they didn't have to do DR, right? If they didn't think about it, they would never have to need it. It turns out that this is all about how avoiding to have to use your DR. Not having no DR, it's about having to avoid having to use it. At first blush, it's really an odd title, but it makes sense once you think through it.
Yeah,
and the other thing with that, Sujeet, I wanted to mention was this is a guide about how to configure that, how to best configure that on infrastructure as a service, but we also have another version of that, which is kind of like the PaaS model, right? It's in the cloud. So we have two different ways to use TFS like that. So I just want to call it out.
You mean Visual Studio Online? Is that what you're talking about?
Yep.
Yeah, so actually a little nugget, and I'm not going to disclose the product group that's doing it, but just to give you a sense of how confident we are in Visual Studio Online, I know of at least one major product group in the Windows world, the big world. You know, there's all kinds of products in the Windows space, but that is actually using Visual Studio Online as its primary TFS instance.
That's good to know. I guess, you know, we got to eat our own dog food, as they say, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was really kind of surprised to hear it, but I mean, I guess it makes sense, right? I mean, if it's if we're truly building something that is world class, it's going to meet all the security and you know, access and all that stuff,
performance
that we have ours. Yeah, exactly.
Yep, that's a great point, Evan. All right, so we'll put a note to that in the show notes. Let's go down to the second one. This was interesting. I mean, to be honest with you, I think all of us, none of us knew what an ECC was. It's an elliptic curve cryptography certificate. All right. So I said, I guess normal SSL certificates are what, RSA, or is that the difference here? What are the normal SSL certificates? How are they? Are they AES? I know there's DES,
well, there's
and
AES. Yeah,
right?
There's a whole bunch of different ones, and you know, we've had to, you know, increase the number of byte.
Right, number of bits.
Number of bits in the keys to keep up with computational. Yeah. And I guess this just completely flips that on its head.
Yeah, this is something new. It's called the elliptic curve cryptography certificate, which makes the keys harder by a factor of 10 to crack, you know?
Yeah.
So if you thought SSL was safe, this is 10 times as safe, I suppose. it's nice that, you know, Microsoft Azure is going to support that. So in case we have any of our customers that are really, really concerned about this, about the security behind the SSL logic, they could get an ECC certificate and put it in Azure now. And then moving on to the third one, Evan, do you know anything about this Azure AD application proxy?
Yeah, just a little. So, right, you know, the Azure Active Directory Premium, right, is really all the stuff that we're laying on top of the core functionality of Windows Azure Active Directory. And what the AD application proxy does, and really the key part to think about, is the proxy piece, right? What it allows you to do is to drop a proxy on your on-premises machine, and then now it's going to proxy traffic, you know, by working with the service component. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to make a request to the public endpoint, which is embedded in Azure Active Directory, and then it's going to proxy that HTTP or HTTP request back to your on-premises, component or service or whatever it is, and then that service response, HTTP or HTTPS responses, and then it proxies them back. So you have this way to kind of tunnel through your edge devices and your firewall without having to actually move your stuff out into the edge and firewall.
I see.
Well, it's really got a lot of potential there.
You know what? That's one of the problems we've had at my customer is we've had to build custom proxies, you know, when we want to do federation with other authentication providers, and it looks like this is like a nice generic proxy that they're giving you.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to get. I mean, again, it's all about you may not be able to move this. You know, let's say you've got some web service or WCF service that talks to a database. Well, you probably don't want. You're not ready to move your database out, and you don't have a VPN. Well, you can leverage this to proxy the communications between your hosted components and your on-premises components at that point. And one thing that I don't know, and I need to do a little bit more digging, I think maybe as this matures, maybe we should do a show on it, but I wonder if it's definitely limited to HTTP and HTTPS stuff, but I wonder if, you know, like, can you do to almost any application, right? I mean, what's the kind of range of things you can do it with? Well, I'll have to dig into this a little bit more and see, but it seems really promising.
Yep. Well, I'm sure, as you said, we'll probably have to cover it in detail in another show all by itself. The fourth item on our list today of new items is something called Docker. And some of our listeners might know what Docker is, but because it's a relatively new technology, let me just go over that real briefly. And what Docker is, it's an open source technology that contains applications within things called containers. today we all love VMs in the IaaS model because a VM is a container. It's our own personal container. We build the operating system. We put our libraries on there and we put our apps on there in one container and we can, in one VM, so to speak, and we can give it to anybody and they can just spin it up and they're up and running in no time. But the problem is, you know what the size of a VM is. It's into the 20 and 30 gigabytes, if not more. And so it's a very big, bulky package, and it takes a long time to install and get it right the first time. So what Docker is they've taken an approach is that, why do we have to give a copy of the operating system to every application that needs the VM? Let's create a container, and the container is just the application and its libraries, okay? The actual operating system is not included in the container. And the operating system, in this case, happens to be it's Linux-based for now, and I'm sure we'll eventually get it working on a Windows system. But the part that is neat is that now, if I were to give somebody a quote-unquote VM, right, in this new model, the Docker container, it's actually a very small package. It just contains the apps and the libraries required to run the apps. The Docker engine and the host operating system and the server on which it's sitting are shared by all these containers. So the nice thing about it is that because we're all sharing the same infrastructure at the low level, we can run many more apps on the same infrastructure compared to an IaaS model. And so the big news that for our listeners is that this is now supported in Microsoft Azure under the Linux extensions in IaaS that we have today. But guys, Kale, you may kind of relate to this more than Evan, is that this seems fairly similar to the app domain model in .NET, no?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about this product specifically, the Docker thing, but what I had understood was exactly what you said. Like, you're able to basically create these containers, these logical containers, and have multiple apps to run on the same infrastructure so that you can set that up once and kind of run it again. So I'm trying to, in my head, kind of figure out what's the difference between that and some of the other models. We have like our imaging model where essentially we have the infrastructure too, but we're laying multiple apps on that. So I don't know if you guys know the difference, but I'm trying to work that out myself.
You said the infrastructure what?
So like if we had an image where we had multiple applications installed on like our infrastructure, like even IaaS,
mm-hmm.
How does that contrast
that's what I said. That's the app domain model, right? As we know it. Like if you take IaaS to be, the so-called Docker engine, and on IIS we can run, I don't know, 100. How many apps? I guess up to 256 apps, if not more.
Yeah, I would say these days it's a huge number.
It's a huge number, right? So that's, we have some sort of way of compartmentalizing application like that. But this Docker engine seems to be a nice open source way of writing these apps to the Docker engine. And the good thing is that now that Docker engine, if in the future, if you run it on Windows, those apps will just run on the Docker engine on Windows. They shouldn't have to be rewritten or re-architected in any way. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. After I'm reeling from the dig that Sajid forgets that I write code too.
I'm in server side code. I mean, you write client code. I know that.
I supported SQL Server reporting services for years.
I mean, I know you wrote a Windows Phone app. We all know that.
This is actually not just a Linux thing. Docker is truly multi-platform, right? So your applications on top are just portable, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's supposed to be like that. But our initial foray into Azure is going to be the Linux virtual machine. They're only going to support it on Linux.
Okay, gotcha.
Using the Linux extensions on IaaS. And as I said, I'm pretty sure that in the future it'll probably be rolled out onto a Windows system as well. It's an open source thing, so I imagine there'll be demand for it.
I wonder if like some of the other open source things that we've kind of gone full bore on, like HD Insight and some of the other, we've actually started contributing back to the distributions.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you'll see that kind of thing here, which, man, that's really a step out for us as a company.
Yep.
Right? And normally, if we don't write it, we don't touch it. But, you know, now we're actually helping make things better.
And what's really nice about the Docker engine is it solidifies the PaaS model, right? This is the PaaS model personified, and it's good that it's getting a lot of public support in this Docker engine, because I think Microsoft has been saying forever that the PaaS model is the way to go, including our own Mark Resnovich, who says that, you know, the PaaS model is really the kind of the future. So I think we need to keep an eye on this and get more familiar with this Docker engine, and I'm sure we'll cover it in a future episode. It sounds like a good topic to cover. And then moving on to one of Kale's favorite topics, which is PowerShell. Kale?
Yeah, so there's a new version of our commandlets for Azure, and the exact, you know, version is 0.8.3. And so I wanted to talk about that a little bit, about the versioning, because when this came out, I actually did the upgrade to mine, and there was some slight confusion there, even on my part, like, how do I know which one I'm running? But just to step through a couple of the things that this thing does, they did some cleanup on, like, the source code and stuff behind this, so you can go up, I think it's on GitHub, and actually look at the source if you're into that kind of thing. But from a real-world perspective, the big things that it hit on were websites, traffic manager, some stuff about the rules, and some things with HD Insight. So on the website side, basically some new support for the slots now. So something pretty recent that we did with websites is we brought along that new the thing that we had in PaaS for a while, where we had the staging and production slots. In websites now, you can actually, they're user defined, right? So you can define multiple slots.
That's right.
And switch between them. So that's kind of cool. And now now you can do that from PowerShell, which is neat.
Very nice.
It's amazing how fast these come out. I mean, I just picked up 8.2 like 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And so then on the traffic manager side, we have support for weighted round-robin policies and some performance policies on the external endpoints. You can read more about that if you're into the global traffic distribution, our traffic manager product.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the role side, we have some new support for things like getting Azure role size, some affinity group stuff, just a couple different things about the roles, so more on the PaaS side of things. And then on the HD Insight, there's this new cluster type parameter to HD Insight. I don't have a lot on that one. But to step back a little bit, I saw this the other day, so I was like, oh, I always upgrade right away when they put these out because I like to play with these new ones. And I was just like Evan, I was on 8.2, I thought. So I was like, oh, I think I'm running 8.2. And so I went up. The normal way that I actually do these installs is through the platform installer. Mm-hmm. And when I went up there, I couldn't even tell what version it was at first. It was like, yeah, the PowerShell scripts are here, or the PowerShell commandlets are here, but the date looked a little different. And so then it got me thinking, like, well, what version am I actually running? And I got a link that we can put in the notes, but it got me thinking about, how do you even tell that? Like, how do you tell? I mean, you can go into add remove programs maybe and see it. But the easy way to do it that I found was I just did a quick dig on it. And if you just set in PowerShell, if anybody's familiar with PowerShell, you can set these flags in there to basically turn on like verbose or debug logging in your console while you're running your PowerShell commands. So if you just do $debug preference and set it to continue, where you enable these debug messages to come through, mm-hmm. and then just call one of the commands, don't even pass parameters to it, just call any of the Azure PowerShell commands. When you get the dump out, you'll see right away at the top, it'll say what version of PowerShell scripts run, so their commandlets.
That's good to know, because I just went to add remove the other day to find out what version I had.
Yeah, but again, I was going to ask you, I mean, this versioning number is a little odd to me. I'm used to seeing PowerShell version 2 and 3, right? So that's the engine, correct? And these are the commandlets. Is that the difference?
Yeah, these are the commandlets, yeah.
Okay. So this is the when they say Azure PowerShell 0.8.3, it means the PowerShell commandlets for Azure.
Yep.
Okay. But it would require like a version 3 PowerShell engine, right, to run on probably?
Yeah, they usually give those prereqs if you look in the install notes of which ones. But yeah, it's usually at least 2 back. Like it's whatever is current, which is like right now 4, goes back to 3, sometimes 2.
Okay.
Depends on what they do, but yeah.
Okay.
The thing that jumps out at me about this is, you know, you look at all the functionality that we've released, and it's still only, it's still not a 1.0 yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. When is that going to happen? Yeah. Probably never.
Yeah. Permanent beta.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the roundup of all the latest news. That was a nice bunch. As I said, you know, we've been very busy. The product team has been busy. Kale's, Evan's team has been busy getting all these things together, and we're looking forward to all the new updates for the next week as well. But for now, what we want to try and cover is a real-world scenario that one of our listeners by the name of Sean posted to us on our Twitter link. So I'm going to read his scenario, and then we're just going to discuss it. Give the listeners some feedback on the use case, which we thought was pretty good. It goes like this. So my company is using CMS to run its several websites. And traditionally, CMS handles both the content management and the presentation concerns. We've decided to split the two between CMS and the Microsoft Azure websites on Azure. By doing that, we converted CMS to be solely a back office for business users to enter content, and Azure websites to handle the design, presentation, and presentation logic. Since we're using a commercial CMS, it is limited to the number of content distribution delivery service that we can use. I guess it's some kind of licensing deal that they have. And see, the idea is, why not run these CDSs on Azure IS, where the CDSs expose some sort of an HTTP endpoint to get to the content as data, like maybe some sort of an API, a REST API. And then these CDSs can run behind an Azure load balancer, and then the Azure website instances, which, you know, you could scale up infinitely, you could start small and move to larger instances, for example, and those things are not limited by the CMS licensing. They're just doing all the presentation. They would access all the logic in the on the data in the CMS, you know, through those APIs that we just talked about, and serve up a presentation to users. The nice thing about it is one of the issues that Sean highlights is that the CMS can be slow at times, okay, because it is, you know, just that's just the nature of the CMSs, I suppose. And he is proposing that they use the Azure Cache service as a way to absorb some of these performance issues by caching some of the information from the CMS in the cache service, and then, you know, allowing quicker access from Azure websites. So guys, what are your thoughts on this, on what Sean is mentioning? I thought it was a really well laid out scenario, and seems to me very ripe for moving to Azure. But I guess I'm, you know, slanted in that way.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it really seems to be kind of picking it, and this is really the goal for Microsoft Azure, right, which is that you pick and choose the things you want, mm-hmm. right? This, you know, Sean wants, you know, caching, and he wants the, you know, functionality of Moz or the scalability, you know, and price points of Moz, you know, and the ability to use Traffic Manager, but he doesn't want to, you know, pay for the IaaS and there gets some licensing stuff. So he it's kind of an a la carte thing. Right, and he really gets the capabilities he wants without having to buy the whole thing.
Yes, of course. The one thing that he knows, he realizes he's going to have to do is use. You're going to have to build all that logic into the Azure websites today. Right, today it's all kind of embedded into the CMS, and he's going to split it up into two, which means there's going to be some work involved in writing some of this code to run on Azure websites. But the upshot of all this is that now you're kind of separating the presentation logic from the CMS, and that way, you know, you're not restricting yourself to what the CMS can do. You know, I mean, CMSs are these big monolithic things. They typically do not rev as fast as we would like them to all the latest and greatest technologies. And he's, you know, his solution is, in part, it's splitting that into two, where the monolithic part remains in the CMS, whereas the more dynamic part, which is the web presentation layer, the website itself, is on Azure websites, and that can be, you know, kept more fresher using more up-to-date technologies, you know, the Web 2.0 and whatnot. That's how I saw it.
Yeah, no. Go ahead, Kale.
No, go ahead. It's fine.
I was going to say the other thing that jumped out at me is, right, by doing this split, he now has, in a lot of ways, taken his application and segregated it nicely from his CMS,
mm-hmm.
right? So he can rev CMS without worrying about taking down his website. Or he can rev, he could even change CMSs, I guess. As long as he had those endpoints still working, it wouldn't impact his application at all.
Great point, yeah. He just builds a nice, robust API to kind of surround the CMS to an abstraction layer, so to speak. And as long as he keeps that interface and contract the same, he could swap out the CMS with something else, you're right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was just about to mention, Evan. The decoupling of that is huge, you know, not just from the standpoint of, like, now he's not tied to a specific CMS, but it's also, you know, sometimes we use CMS systems, and you don't have a lot of editors. Let's say we had even like 30 or 40 people that are actually editing this content that's going to be displayed to the public, and maybe the public website is going to be used by 50,000 people. You know, and if you're limited, like, you have this one-to-one relationship between your content delivery servers and the thing that people are editing in your CMS, decoupling that makes it better, right? Because we can just scale the other side of it now, the presentation side that the end users are going to hit. They don't know any different. We can just keep adding servers there to make the thing go as fast as we need.
Yeah. Now, are these, I mean, like, I've worked on some support cases with these kind of applications, but, like, are CMS, commercial CMS software, are those, like, big dollar things, or are those?
Well, I mean, he doesn't tell us which particular CMS they're using, but I know from working with some of my customers, Documentum is a big name in CMS. Okay, I'm not saying this is the one that because we don't know which one Sean is using, but Documentum is, those things are, you know, millions of dollars. So they're
big dollars. This is not just a little bit of money. This is, you know, serious money. Yeah. So you're pretty committed to this when you do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think they scale, right? We have stuff like in Azure now, even like up there as templates like Orchard and things like that, which are, I'm not saying they're small CMSs. I'm sure they can support huge loads, but they're kind of like very easy to get going with, to get started with and start using, up to the stuff like Sajid's talking about, which is like the monsters, you know?
Yeah.
Right. But it's also the amount of documents that you have, you know, the share. But when you grow in volume like that, that's where the big boys come in.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to mention that I've seen personally when I worked with CMSs years ago, what we typically did was we wanted to scale the front end that the end user saw a lot. And again, we had this publishing model where we had, you know, non-technical users or even semi-technical users editing the content. And so there's this whole workflow of, like, you know, publishing and that kind of thing. But what we ended up doing was actually leveraging things like CDN, which I know that Azure's beefing up some support for that. We've partnered with some people on that now. And in that model, you can publish HTTP content out in the CDN origin, which then gets broadcast over the world. And then all your Azure websites, so if you had multiple in different regions, can access those things. You know, from the client side, it's going to say, I'm in, you know, Brazil, so I'm going to hit this data center, and it makes things a lot faster. So that's another thing to think about.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So Sean should consider posting some of his public content to the CDNs, right, from the CMS. Is that what you're saying, Kevin?
Yeah, it depends. You have to take a look at the content, but if it's relatively static or things like that, those are ones that are really good candidates for doing that kind of thing so you can increase performance. And again, based on like what his situation is, I don't know if he's global or if it's localized, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think you also pick up, I think if they go this route, although I think you could theoretically do it with CMS, but, you know, I assume there's probably some problems trying to keep two copies of your CMS system in sync. Right, because they both have access to the central database.
Mm-hmm.
You could even imagine with this scenario where he's making calls to the back end on a irregular basis. Most of the stuff is going to cache. He could theoretically stick two copies of this in two different data centers and use Traffic Manager, and now he's got a DR scenario as well.
Yep,
mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Which I'm assuming most CMSs, that's a pretty non-trivial thing to do.
Right. You would typically have this elaborate cluster formation or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
To try and yeah, and doing geo. And he talks about, you know, being able to do geo distribution, which I think is really a key thing. Yeah. And Evan, you touched upon one thing real briefly, but I think it's really big. Is, you know, when you have this sort of difference in capacity between your front end, which is Azure websites, and your back end, which in this case is the CMS system, you've got to have a way to absorb the load from one to the other, because you're going to have a limited number of back ends, but almost unlimited number of front ends. And I think Sean brings up a good idea of using the Azure cache service, which we've talked about in a previous episode. What the application can do, the front-end application can retrieve the content that it needs as the pages are being displayed from the CMS one time, and then drop it into the caching into the cache service, and thereafter just get the information from the cache service and set up some sort of expiration policy, and that way they're not hitting the CMS too much, other than a few hits a day at the start of the day or whenever people hit a particular piece of content for the first time. So that's really key to enabling this whole system to scale up to a large number of users without having to buy those expensive CMS licenses.
Yeah, no, that's now we just got to remind Sean that if this turns into some big massive commercial success, he's got to kick back some portion of the architecture money to us at
yeah.
this point. Since we've
absolutely, I'll be sure to remind him on Twitter on that too. I think this is a very good approach. And this kind of ties into our discussion we had last time, which is, you know. And another approach would be to keep the Azure websites, in Azure, of course, and then access through the VPN, the CMS on premises. But again, I think we all agree that's not a good idea, right? Especially if the CMS is slow as it is, going over a VPN is just going to make it a lot slower. And
yeah,
it could be chatty and all that whatnot.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the question here really becomes, how cacheable is your data? Mm-hmm. Right. If it's super cacheable, where this stuff really only changes, you know, at most once a day, I think that might be a reasonable solution. But if you have something that, you know, if you have fairly dynamic content, yeah, I think having the CMS in Azure rather than on premises is probably the more efficient solution at that point.
Right. Okay, great. Yeah, and you know, if you tie this all to what you just said with a good cache exploration policy, some reasonable time frame, which is, you know, just a matter of configuration. The application on the front end all it does is looks into the cache for a piece of content. It's not there. Go to CMS, get it, put it into the cache, serve it up, and now everybody else benefits from that. So it's a fairly clean way. And the other thing I think that came out of our discussion today was having those good contracts on the API that it's going to be exposed from the CMS. Having that has to be thought out and designed well, because you only want to do that once, and you want to write your application to that contract. And then, as we said, in the future, if they feel they need a different kind of CMS, they can swap it out for something else without change, and hopefully not change contract. Great. That's good. Thanks, Sean, for sending that in. That was a really nice scenario, and I want to encourage our listeners, if you do have such thoughts about, you know, moving to Azure, or you have an existing system and you think that might be a good candidate to move to Azure, if it's, you know, at a high level, we can certainly have a discussion like this. Of course, we do have people like Kale and Evan, who also do this at a more in-depth level as part of their jobs at Microsoft. So I don't want to discount that. We're just giving you a very high-level architecture guidance over here. And if you don't need to get into the nuts and bolts of how to lay this out, Microsoft has a lot of help and services that we can offer as well. Well, I think that's a wrap for this podcast. Thanks, Kale and Evan, for all your thoughts and comments. And we'll see you guys next week.
See you, folks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.